these two species as species of fermions, which are on the left or on the right. And for positive energy, it was more natural to describe the two species of fermions as motion here, like this. In other words, for low energies, it's more natural to separate, to think of the two species of fermions as having negative lambda or positive lambda, with ill-defined or changing a sign of p. P is positive, is negative here, and positive when the guy comes back. On the other hand, for positive energies, the two species of fermions are not associated with positive and negative lambda. They are not associated with the left and the right side of the potential. Instead, they are associated with particles with well-defined sign of the momentum. They come from the left and shoot like that, or they come from the right and shoot like that. This thing that physics below the barrier and above the barrier, the language is different. In one case, we should better be thinking in terms of lambda being positive or negative. In the other case, we should better be thinking in terms of p being positive or negative and lambda changing sign. This is a sign of the non-locality, which is intrinsic in this problem. We have established a formalism which treats uniformly both the physics below the barrier and above the barrier, and is particularly suitable for treating energies which are exactly at the tip of the potential, where the physics is most strongly coupled. Again, the semi-classical intuition of the barrier reflecting is really appropriate for very low energies. The semi-classical picture of going through the barrier like that is really appropriate for very large and positive energies. Either way, we see two species of fermions associated with the fact that the Hilbert space for fixed energy has two states. The two different eigenstates were such that we continuously move from eigenstates that look like this to eigenstates that look like that. But where is the difference between them? Is that if we pick a basis of incoming states that come like that, the basis of outgoing states is either approximately the same or is approximately rotated, appropriate depending on energy negative or energy positive, and we've seen that in more detail. So now I'd like to take this picture and translate it in more detail to space-time. And the Z2 symmetry that exchanges lambda with minus lambda and the momentum with minus the momentum, and therefore S to minus S and U to minus U, which exchanges the two kinds of fermions. This is the symmetry that we have identified in our space-time description. In the Schwarzschild description is minus 1 to the F left. This is the space-time fermion number. And in space-time, we call the charge conjugation. Which acts as C goes to minus C, and T remains invariant. Therefore, our dictionary between space-time and the matrix model is that ripples of T, maybe I should say quanta of T, are even perturbations of the two Fermi Cs. Quanta of C are odd perturbations of the two Fermi Cs. This language, in terms of two Fermi Cs, is a bit confusing, so let me clarify it a little bit. Once we are at low energies, our ground state has two Fermi Cs like that. So that's the picture that we often have in mind. We have two Fermi Cs, and if we have even perturbations, even ripples on these Fermi Cs, this is the field T, and if we have odd perturbations, go a little bit up here and a little bit down here, This is the C field. But what should we say when we are above the barrier? Above the barrier, superficially, we have only one Fermi C. That's where our language in terms of S and U is really more powerful. We have one Fermi C here, so we really have two Fermi Cs here, because we work in terms of lambda. Fermions with negative lambda are here, and fermions with positive lambda are here. Similarly, we have two Fermi Cs here, despite appearance. These are fermions which move to the left, to the right, as opposed to fermions which move to the left. So we should really be thinking in terms of having two Fermi Cs, both below the barrier and above the barrier. The two Fermi Cs are fermions which are on the left and on the right side of the potential. That's below the barrier. And above the barrier, we should think of two Fermi Cs, or fermions which move this way and fermions which move that way. That's the only way to make the picture of going from below the barrier to above the barrier consistent. We will also see later that physics below the barrier and physics above the barrier are related by some kind of duality, duality that exchanges lambda and p, and therefore fermions with positive lambda and negative lambda below the barrier translates to fermions with positive p and negative p above the barrier. And I'll do that in more detail. So these are the first kind of quanta we can scatter. These are the quanta which are visible on the world sheet. The world sheet gave us some description of the quanta we can scatter, and these are these, quanta of T and the quanta of C. But we also mentioned, when we discussed the world sheet theory, that the boson C is a compact scalar, and we can send in a wave which winds around the circle. More precisely, there's a dimension one operator in the conformal field theory at infinity, which is I root 2 plus or minus C in, or e to the plus or minus I square root of 2 C out. Well, these are the left and the right moving components of the scalar field C. What do they translate to? Well, from the world sheet point of view, they are not obvious. These are non-perturbative excitations, like solitons in the string description. However, the dispersion relation is massless. So one novelty of this theory, which will be very important later, is that this theory has massless excitations which are not visible in the world sheet. The world sheet treatment does not see such non-perturbative excitations. We are used to the fact that the world sheet does not see non-perturbative excitations, for example, D-brains. We need to introduce boundaries and so forth. But now we see such non-perturbative excitations which are massless. Okay, they are there. The matrix model shouldn't miss anything. How should we describe them? The interpretation of these is the following. Let me, for simplicity, be below the barrier. So we have these two Fermi Cs. This thing carries the charge, which is part of the SU2 symmetry. This is J plus or J minus, depending on the sign here. So the first excitations that we can have, we can take one of the fermions from below the Fermi C, put it here above, and leave a hole behind. That's a nice excitation to consider. We take one of the fermions, we give it a little bit of energy above the Fermi C, and then we send it in. So what we send in is both a fermion and a hole. We don't change the fermion number. Fermion number that comes from the left is as it was before in the ground state, but this is clearly an excitation of the ground state. So this is a good thing to do. That's a naive and simple thing to do. There's a more interesting excitation, which from the matrix model looks a little bit unnatural. Let us not take a fermion from here, lift it above the Fermi C, and send it in, a fermion hole pair, but remove a hole from here and send it in, and add a fermion here and send it in. From the point of view of the matrix model, this is a non-local excitation. We annihilate a fermion here, and we create a fermion over there, and we let this pair run in. If we think of the matrices as matrices, there's nothing strange about that. These are all eigenvalues, just happen to be in different places. From space-time, this is a more natural thing to do. because recall that the two different asymptotics of the matrix model are identified as the same weak coupling asymptotic of space-time. So from the space-time point of view, this is not non-local at all. It's perfectly local. We send an excitation from the asymptotic end of space-time, an excitation which is described in the matrix model as a fermion coming from here and a hole coming from there. I'd like to interpret this excitation as e to the I root 2 c in. So this soliton that is so hard to see in the wall sheet has a natural interpretation in the matrix model. It's sending an equal number of fermions from the left and from the right. In hindsight, it's not surprising. We had a scalar field C, and we had a current DC. This current measures charge. What is the charge that it measures? It measures the number of fermions on the left minus the number of fermions on the right. So the charge DC, the current DC, is associated with number of fermions with lambda positive minus the number of fermions with lambda negative. This object carries charge under this symmetry. And therefore, we interpret it as sending a fermion from here and a hole from here. That makes sense. It doesn't take a lot of inspiration to know what this guy is, a fermion here and a hole here. If this had a plus sign, this has the opposite charge. Here we had more fermions on the right than on the left. Here we have more fermions on the left than on the right. So this is e to the minus I square root of 2 c in. Notice that C in space-time, we say left-moving guys. And here, they have both left-moving and right-moving. Because they're left-moving and right-moving in terms of lambda, but they're only left-moving in terms of space-time. Or maybe my conventions were that they were right-moving. But they were all of the same chirality. Once we had these two objects with C in, we can ask ourselves, do we have room for C out? In the world sheet, we had, or in space-time, we had these two chiral fields, incoming and outgoing, which can carry this charge. So we should have similar solitons like this, except that they are associated with out, with the out state. So here comes an important point about this system. We really have to be very clear, we really have to remember that we are interested in an S-matrix element. S-matrix is a map from the past to the future. So whatever we do in the past should have analogous things in the future. So if we go back to the same picture, what we'll do in the future is consider a state where a fermion comes like that, and a hole comes here, or alternatively, a hole moves here, and a fermion moves to here. This object will be e to the I root 2 c out, and this will be e to the minus I root 2 c out. Notice that in the conformal field theory, all of these are dimension one operators. So all the things that we can, so these are good things to insert into the path integral in space-time. So this is a nice physical interpretation of these non-perturbative excitations, and it's clear that as we scatter any of these excitations, any other of them can come out. In particular, we can have a scattering process where we take one of the most naive initial conditions, a fermion here and a hole here, both move here. But the outgoing state is the fermion moving here and the hole reflected back. This is non-perturbatively suppressed. The fermion bounced in a natural way. The fermion did not bounce back, but the fermion managed to penetrate. We need an instanton to do that. And hence, the amplitude behaves like e to the minus some constant times the energy, because this fermion had to penetrate under the barrier. But such an amplitude is non-zero. In traditional treatments of the C equals one model, most of it was associated with the bosonic string, such processes were ignored. They were ignored because they were non-perturbatively small. Our goal now is to have a complete description of the system, including the non-perturbative physics, complete description which allows us to interpolate between mu negative and mu positive. So for mu positive, sorry, for mu negative, which in my convention is below the barrier, such a process is exponentially suppressed. But it's physically possible. We can also consider other processes where the outgoing state is also the hole here. Then both the initial and the final states look like perturbative excitations, but both the fermion and the hole had to tunnel, and therefore this is also exponentially suppressed. So this would be an exponentially small process of scattering of perturbative quanta, not of these guys. But these guys necessarily involve non-perturbative physics. Let us make this slightly more quantitative. Our scattering process is characterized by four numbers. The number of fermions which come from the left, the number of fermions which come from the right, and similarly two numbers in the future. So in the past, we take our n fermions. And we let the total number of fermions here be n over 2. My convention is that plus little n in. This is the total number of fermions coming this way. And the total number of fermions coming that way is n over 2 minus n in. And in the future, we have the same n over 2 plus n out coming back that way, and n over 2 minus n out going that way. So the scattering process is characterized by three integers, n, which we take to infinity. We don't have four. There are four entries here, 1, 2, 3, 4. We don't have four different entries because the total number of fermions, which is n, does not change. So we limit ourselves to processes which do not change the total number of fermions. And therefore, in addition to big N, which we're going to take to infinity, our scattering process, in addition to all the other parameters like energy and which particular fermion and so forth, kind of the big picture is that it's described by two integers. The imbalance of fermion numbers between the left and the right in the past, and the imbalance between the left and the right of outgoing fermions. How can we interpret these numbers? Well, it's clear that this n in is the eigenvalue of J3 in, which was in our SU2 in. And n out is the eigenvalue of J out 3 in SU2 out. Again, the incoming and the outgoing states, we sit very far asymptotically. We have SU2 cross SU2 symmetry. And these integers, n in and n out, are nothing but the third component of isospin of these two SU2s. This is clear both from the bosonization. If we bosonize the fermions, then this is the fermion number, which is the difference between the two. It's also clear from this picture that these guys carry charge 1 or minus 1. Maybe my conventions for the signs here is opposite to what it is there. But the important thing is that these things carry charge 1 as opposed to charge minus 1 here, and again, 1 for the out state and 1 for the out state. Is there any question about this identification of the charges? So this way of characterizing the motion in the far past and in the far future is really independent of whether the Fermi surface is here or here. I could have drawn these two pictures without the Fermi surface at all. We don't care where the Fermi surface is. So this is a useful way of thinking about it, because it does not make reference to whether the Fermi surface is positive or negative. It's kind of ready for going above or below the barrier. Where is the distinction between whether the Fermi surface is positive or negative? Well, this distinction comes about when we discuss the amplitude, not the state, but the transition amplitude from one kind of state to another. Let us first ignore various non-perturbative effects, various instantons. So neglecting instantons, the scattering picture below the barrier and above the barrier is different, and it is depicted over there. So below the barrier, which in my convention is mu negative, this is really different than the rest of the world, but I like to measure energies from below to above. Most people like to measure energy downward for the chemical potential, but not for regular energy. Anyway, that's my convention for energy. Here, it's clear that if we start with some number of fermions here, and we end with some number of fermions there, then the large amplitude, the amplitude, or maybe I should say the S matrix, is large for n in, approximately equal n out. Most of the fermions that we send in come back out. A small fraction of them can tunnel through. This is to be contrasted with a situation like that. Here, the large entries in the S matrix are when n in is approximately equal to minus n out. When we are above the barrier, we can still characterize the states this way. In that sense, it's a universal way of characterizing them. But the dominant amplitude is not when n in equals n out. We don't want all these fermions to come back. Instead, we want the fermions that come back on this side to start their lives on the other side. So above the barrier, this line separates the two pictures, and this is the Fermi C. So if we send some fermions here or here, see, most of them will go through, and therefore n in will be minus n out. This is similar, or another way of saying, something that we have seen yesterday when we looked at the one-body wave functions. We saw that one-body wave functions for energies, with negative energies below the barrier, were such that the incoming state and the outgoing state were correlated one way. The plus went with the plus and the minus went with the minus. Above the barrier, the situation was exactly the opposite. The plus went with approximately with the minus and the other way around. So this is another reflection of the same thing. So this looks like some kind of a conservation law. Below the barrier, the total number of fermions on the left is approximately conserved. The total number of fermions on the right is approximately conserved. Above the barrier, we have a minus sign here. So what is conserved is a minus charge. So let us say it a little bit more algebraically. For mu negative, which is here, J in 3 is approximately equal to J out 3. In other words, the SU2 cross SU2 symmetry, which is a symmetry of the asymptotic theory and is not a symmetry of the full theory, is explicitly broken by the scattering process. The scattering process breaks it. But one U1 is approximately conserved. It's a U1 which is formed as a linear combination of the two diagonal U1 elements from here and here. For mu positive, J in 3 is approximately equal to J3 minus J3 out. So as exact statements, The two SU2s are gone, and the two U1s are gone. But as an approximate statement, one U1 symmetry remains, approximately conserved, but that U1 is different below the barrier and above the barrier. So below the barrier, one U1 is conserved, and it's violated only by instantons. So everything is broken at tree level out of the SU2 cross SU2, except one U1, which is broken by instantons. As we make the energy closer and closer to the barrier, these instanton effects become stronger and stronger, and eventually they are of order one. They are the same thing as what we would otherwise call tree effects. As we keep going up above the barrier, this U1, which was originally violated only by instantons, is now broken very much, by a lot. Instead, another U1, the other linear combination, becomes approximately conserved, and it's violated only by instantons. So what are these instantons? Below the barrier, the instantons are transitions which penetrate like that. Above the barrier, these are transitions which are hard to draw because they penetrate like that. So if we go above a barrier in quantum mechanics, no matter how high we go, there's still a non-trivial amplitude for reflection back. That's an instanton. It's an instanton that should better be thought of as an instanton in momentum space rather than coordinate space. So just as a TA session, let's do an exercise. Say we are below the barrier, and we start with two electrons, two fermions here, and a hole here, and maybe a fermion here, and a two holes here. So that has n in equals one. And we can try and finish in the future with one fermion here and a hole here, and two fermions here, and two holes here. So that would say that n out is zero. Such a scattering process is possible, and it is suppressed by non-perturbative effect, right, because it's mediated by instanton. And we need one instanton in order to mediate the transition, because one of these two fermions has to tunnel. And you can have more and more fun with constructing more and more of these examples. Let me say a few more words that explain this difference between physics below and above the barrier from the point of view that I stressed in the first lecture. We discussed this S-duality symmetry. So where will I put it? We discussed the S-duality symmetry. This was a duality that in the world sheet was minus one to the F left. In space-time, it took T to minus T, and C plus to C plus, and C minus to minus C minus. Or in the notation we use today, this would be, say, in, and this would be in, this would be out, and this would be out. So this can also be written as C mapped to its dual. So we had this Z2 transformation, which was an exact symmetry of the matrix model, exact symmetry in space-time, and it had the effect of changing the sign of T, and therefore it changed the sign of mu. So that's an exact symmetry at mu equals zero, and it relates physics with positive mu to physics with negative mu. In terms of the matrix model, it interchanges physics below the barrier with physics above the barrier. We have seen that physics below the barrier and above the barrier superficially look very different. Here we have almost complete reflection, and here we have almost complete transmission. But we saw that qualitatively it looks very different, but if we look at it even from afar, they look very much the same, except that we have to change a few words. What are the words that we have to change? Here, instead of working with coordinate states, we have to look at momentum states. So there were various minus signs, whether the plus goes to plus or the plus goes to minus, whether n in it goes to n out or n in goes to minus n out. This has a very natural interpretation in the matrix model. Let us first understand it in terms of lambda and p. Our Hamiltonian was a half p squared minus lambda squared. This Hamiltonian has a symmetry, duality symmetry, which exchanges p and lambda. And energy goes to minus energy. So as a first approximation, the symmetry that takes us from below the barrier to above the barrier is a duality transformation on the matrix model coordinates. We think of lambda as being a space-time, as a target space coordinate, it looks insane. We exchange momentum and coordinate in a field theory. We normally don't do that. But from the matrix model, where lambda is the target space, that's a good thing to do. We actually have to be a little bit more precise here. We cannot exchange lambda and p. We can take p to lambda and lambda to minus p. Who can tell me why there's a signs change between these two? What? The commutation relations of the Poisson structure, very good. The duality transformations always have such a minus sign because we have to preserve the commutation relations. Superficially, this is not a Z2 symmetry. Because if we do it twice, we don't come back to where we started. We have to do it four times in order to come back to where we started. There's another problem with this symmetry. We change the total energy to minus the energy. So if we are below the barrier, so we fill all these levels, what this transformation does changes the sign of the energy and fills all these energies. Or more precisely, it fills these energies. Well, it's the passive and active. So this is not really a symmetry of the full second quantized problem. To have it a full symmetry of the second quantized problem, we have to accompany that by psi goes to psi dagger. In other words, we have to combine a duality transformation on lambda and p with a transformation of fermions and Hall's. If we do that, then it is a symmetry of the matrix model. So the matrix model has a Z2 symmetry, which does the following. We exchange lambda and p with this minus sign, flip the sign of the Hamiltonian, and convert, take psi to psi dagger. Let me write it in more explicitly. How do we take a function of lambda and write it as a function of p? Right? We have to do a duality transformation. The easiest way to do that is by a Fourier transform. So the symmetry that we have is psi of lambda and p map to 1 over root 2 pi integral dp e to the I p x, or lambda, psi dagger of p and t. Or if you prefer, you can integrate here the lambda, get a function of p, and put lambda here. Question of choice, or preference. And it's straightforward to take the second quantized Lagrangian that I had yesterday, plug in this transformation, and see that it's a symmetry of the Lagrangian. Equivalently, or another exercise that I recommend you do, show that this transformation is a Z2 transformation rather than a Z4 transformation. In other words, when you do it twice, you come back to yourself, and you will see that it's crucial to complex conjugate here. Otherwise, it's not true. because you have to do inverse Fourier transform, and the inverse Fourier transform has a minus sign, and you get the extra minus sign here in the exponent by taking the complex conjugation. And intuitively, this is needed because we want to convert all the fermions to Hall when we flip all the signs of the energy. Fortunately, in our SNU representation, this symmetry is very simple. It acts as follows. Psi S of S and T is mapped to Psi dagger S of S and T. And Psi U of U and T acts as Psi dagger U. There's a minus sign here, which is actually important, like that. So on S, it acts like charge conjugation, and on U, it acts like CP. Charge conjugation accompanied by flip of sign. Or also equivalently, in terms of our in and out states, psi in plus minus is goes to psi in dagger minus plus, and without so in terms of our new variables, where we have relativistic fermions, these are all functions of R and T, the action is very simple. We don't need to do this Fourier transform or the duality transformation. That's not surprising. The S and U variables are manifestly invariant under the duality transformation, maybe up to a sign, where there's no exchange of a lambda and P when we work with these light-like coordinates. So to summarize this discussion, the scattering amplitudes are really characterized by N in and N out, how many fermions we have on the left versus how many fermions we have on the right in the past and in the future. They are non-trivial transitions, changing these numbers. So these are not conserved charges. They are good to label the incoming and the outgoing states, but they are not conserved. One U1 symmetry is approximately conserved for positive energy, and one U1 symmetry is approximately conserved for negative mu, but they are not the same U1 symmetry. And the whole thing is controlled by one Z2 symmetry, this non-trivial Z2 symmetry, which acts as duality in space-time, as duality. It acts as duality in the matrix model. It exchanges lambda and P, and it maps states below the barrier to states above the barrier. And they involve particle-Hall conjugation. This is this complex conjugate here. Any question about this so far? Yes. I'm sorry? Okay. So we start with a state like that. So all the energy levels below the barrier are filled. And this is the barrier. So imagine we are Fermi C is below the barrier. What are we going to do? We're going to map energy to minus energy and map fermions to Halls. As we do that, since we also map fermions to Halls, we're going to end with something like this. If we didn't map fermions to Halls, we would have ended with all these levels filled and all these levels empty. Because every energy state goes to minus itself. Does this answer your question? Who asked this question? Oh, you did. So the transformation takes an energy eigenstate and maps it to minus E, state with minus E. And so a state filled with E is mapped to a state filled minus E. So all filling all the states will correspond to filling all these states above here. If if we do this, if we do it twice, first it's not a symmetry, but second, as an operation, it's not a Z2 operation, it's a Z4 operation. But by doing this extra complex conjugation, it becomes a Z2 operation. Right? If we map, we do it again, it will map this picture to this picture. It also maps this picture to something sensible, rather than all the higher energy. That's in addition to the fact that it's not even a symmetry. This is a symmetry. So we have seen that from many different points of view by now. Physics above the barrier and below the barrier is different, but with non-trivial changes that we have to keep track of. Things which live on the left and live on the right are mapped to things which move to the left and things which move to the right, and so forth. So this is this non-trivial transformation. Any more questions about this? Because before we make it slightly more complicated. I've raised the speed despite your request not to change that. Is that okay, or should I go back to the original speed? It's fine? Some people say it's too slow. So what have we learned? We have learned that the naive matrix model, the traditional matrix model, sets all these little ends to zero, which is fine in perturbation theory, but is not going to be rich enough to describe all the non-perturbative physics. In fact, we don't even have an option whether we like it or not. You could say, well, I don't want to know about these little ends. They're just there to confuse me. I'll just set all these little ends to zero. If we do that, and we limit all our initial states and final states to have all these little ends to zero, we are going to end up with a system which is not unitary. We don't have an option here. The system necessarily has these states because there's really nothing to stop a process, even with n in equals zero, equal number of fermions here and here. There's nothing to stop it from ending up as a state which has unequal numbers on the left and on the right. So this is really part of the Hilbert space that should not be neglected. It's analogous to saying, well, I like field theory, but I don't want to learn about solitons. It's not up to you to decide whether you want to learn it or not. The system has solitons whether you want it or not, and the system is not unitary if you do not include the solitons. So these are solitons in the theory that have to be included. Here it's even more dramatic than what we are used to because these solitons are massless. And even if they are not produced copiously with large mu, positive or negative, they are produced very copiously around mu equals zero. Around mu equals zero, this charge is not conserved at all. And we can start with any number on the left and on the right and end up with any number on the left and on the right. So the next step is now completely obvious. Now that we have learned how to modify the matrix model a little bit by putting some number of fermions here and here and here and here, change the number by a little bit, the next step is to change the number by a lot. That's the way we always do it with physics. Once we learn it for a new effect, first it's a small effect that we're learning. And then we say, well, let's make this effect big. So we are going to change our problem now and consider the situation where both n in and n out are macroscopic. So now that we know how to deal with finite number of quanta, we'll try to consider an infinite number of quanta. Macroscopic number of fermions on the left is different. The total number of fermions on the left and on the right differ by a macroscopic amount. Macroscopic amount, I mean of the same order as big N. What does it mean in practice? Here is our original system with the Fermi C. But now we want to put a lot more fermions here and take them from here. The total number of fermions should be the same. So I'm going to erase this Fermi C. But let's remember where it was. and put more fermions here and less fermions here. So I'm going to call this difference in Fermi level. So this would be mu, and this would be nu in, and this would be minus nu in. So this is a good state to start. We start the system with unequal number, not just unequal number of fermions between the two sides, but unequal Fermi surfaces. So with Fermi surfaces like that, we send it in. If we're well below the barrier, that's not too exciting, because the left side and the right side approximately do not talk to one another. And all these fermions are going to be reflected back, all these fermions will be reflected back. So it is as if we have two separate problems, one with Fermi level mu plus nu in, and the other with Fermi level mu minus nu in. So that's not too exciting. To make it a little bit more exciting, we keep the picture, we keep in mind that what we're really doing here is compute an S matrix. So just as we specify nu in, we can also specify an arbitrary nu out. And let it be, for simplicity, close to nu in, but not exactly the same. What's the amplitude now? Well, if nu in is approximately equal to nu out, the amplitude, no fermion has to tunnel, and the problem really factorizes between the left and the right. So that's still not too exciting. But imagine nu in is not equal exactly to nu out. There are two problems with that. Number one, some fermions need to tunnel. So if we're only interested in classical physics, we don't care. This doesn't happen. But we are more mature than that, and we are interested in this tunneling. And these such amplitudes are non-zero. They are suppressed by the difference, exponentially suppressed in the difference between nu in and nu out, but they are not zero. How many fermions need to move, from one side to the other? In our previous problem, when we only sent in a few more fermions on the left and on the right, then a finite number of instantons was enough to mediate the transition. The transition was suppressed by e to the minus mu times some number of order one. Now, however, the fermion discrepancy on the left between the past and the future is macroscopic. So in order to mediate the transition, we need a macroscopic number of instantons. So the picture as a function of time is that at every given unit time interval, finite number of fermions have to tunnel through. And the total number of instantons that we need is proportional to the total length of time. Equivalently, these are approximately relativistic fermions in lambda space. In S, they are exactly relativistic. So the total time of the process is the same as the total length of the system. So the total number of instantons that we need is proportional both to nu in minus nu out and to the length of the system. Since the length of the system grows with n, the process is really suppressed by e to the minus n. So it's really suppressed, but it's non-zero. It's non-zero, and in particular, as we make mu closer and closer to zero, it's easier and easier to have such a transition. Sorry? There is a question of whether you do it after double scaling or before double scaling. After double scaling, there's an extra n in addition to the n of doubles that you normally have. Shanker's e to the minus n is the e to the minus mu of one instanton. this has an extra factor of n, because we need of order n instantons to mediate the transition. So that's the first subtlety. The second subtlety is that there is really no process that takes us from here to here. This is very close to a discussion I had in space-time in the first lecture, but now from a totally different point of view, I'm trying to use the same notation to make it easy for you. Why isn't it obvious? If nu in is equal to nu out, no problem. Then we don't need any instanton. But if nu in is not equal to nu out, let's just assume without loss of generality that nu in is bigger than nu out, then this state has more energy than this one. Recall, the energy is proportional to the Fermi level square. So if we make such a change in nu, in the Fermi surface, maybe I should write a formula for that. Approximately, the energy is mu plus nu in square coming from this side, plus mu minus nu in square. This is energy in. Energy out is mu plus nu out square plus mu minus nu out square. So if what's the difference between them? E in minus E out. So this has a, well, I'll let you compute it. But it's non-zero. If nu in is not equal to nu out. If nu in equals nu out, it's zero. So if nu in is bigger than nu out, as I tried to keep in this picture, this state has less energy than that. One way to see that, it's clear that if this such a configuration is really not stable, it wants to equilibrate, which means that as nu becomes smaller, the energy becomes smaller. So here nu is smaller than here, so this has less energy than this. So such an amplitude is really zero. There's no amplitude that takes us from here to here because they don't have the same energy and the process conserves energy. How can we fix that? Well, we fix that by saying that the outgoing state indeed has these Fermi surfaces, but there are some ripples here which carry a little bit more energy to compensate for it. We have seen exactly such a situation in the first lecture. In the first lecture, we had parameters, which I called nu in and nu out. These were the Ramon-Ramon fluxes of the C field, the left-moving and the right-moving C field. Equivalently, we had nu and nu tilde, which were the sum and the difference. When any one of them was zero, nu in was equal to nu out or to minus nu out, there was no subtlety in the scattering experiment. But when both nu and nu tilde were non-zero, we needed to add energy proportional to nu out, to nu times nu tilde. Actually, let me do this algebra and see that you get the same answer here. So please help me because I didn't prepare that. So we have here mu square, the two mu square cancels. We have two, if nu in square from here, maybe with the two, minus nu out square, maybe with the two. So that is proportional to that, right? The terms linear in nu cancel between this and that, and mu square cancels between this and that. We are left with that, which is proportional to nu nu tilde. It's the same algebra as in the first lecture. So now that we have this discrepancy between the past and the future, we have to fix the discrepancy by adding more quanta. In other words, there are non-zero amplitudes starting from such Fermi surface configuration going to such Fermi surface configuration, but here we have to add a little bit more ripples to account for the difference in energy. We've seen that in the first lecture in the zero B theory, that we had to add more ripples when the incoming Ramon-Ramon flux was not equal to the outgoing Ramon-Ramon flux. And we've also seen that in the 0A theory, when Q and Q tilde were both non-zero, we had to add more fundamental strings to account for the imbalance. So now we see how in the matrix model the same phenomenon arises. What's the energy of such a configuration? Well, now the past and the future have the same energy. The lowest energy that we can have with these Fermi surfaces is some value. This, as far as the Fermi surfaces, has lower energy, but we have added more quanta such that the energy is the same. So what is the total energy? The total energy in this particular case with nu in, when nu in is bigger than nu out, is determined just by the initial state. And more generally, the total energy, this is just an approximation, the quadratic approximation, the total energy is really some function of the maximum of nu in and nu out. So all the parentheses are balanced. And this thing is the same exercise we did in the first talk, is the same as nu plus nu tilde, which I'll call big nu. So the answer depends not on nu and nu tilde separately, but depend only on their sum. Furthermore, it's clear from this that the total energy is really a half of the energy of mu plus nu plus the energy of mu minus nu. So imagine somebody handed you the solution of the 0B matrix model, the exact formula for the ground state energy, when the two Fermi surfaces are equal and the same, both the left and the right. That's the most naive one. So this is some function of mu. Let it be this function. So in this case, the energy is the energy stored in these fermions plus the energy stored in these fermions. So we go from up to mu plus nu in. So we take the full answer that we have this function E, and we take half of the value up to here plus half of the value up to here. So without doing any calculation, we found an exact expression as a function of three parameters. We had three parameters to begin with, mu, the total Fermi energy, nu in and nu out. That was written in terms of mu, nu and nu tilde, which are the two Ramon-Ramon fluxes. And surprisingly, a function of three variables without doing any calculation is expressed as one function, albeit a very complicated function, but one function of one variable. It's an enormous reduction in the complexity of the problem. For the more mathematically oriented people in the audience, I will say that this thing will eventually lead, if I have time, to holomorphic factorization. Although it's clearly not obvious from here. So we have a function of three variables, which will reduce the function of one variable, which I'll soon compute. I think so. It's the total number of Fermi. It's the total number of the Fermi level is the chemical potential for fermion number. So it's a total fermion number at that state. So you go very, very far in the future, and you measure the total number of fermions, or equivalently, you measure the chemical potential. I think it is well defined. Any more questions? How much time do I still have? Wait, sorry? Ah, good. So let me do this a little bit more quantitatively. How do we find the total energy of the system? So all we need to do is now find this function and we are done. So I'll try to fit it in this box. So the total energy is an integral from minus infinity, doesn't matter what the cutoff is, to mu. I'm still performing the same sin of denoting both the one particle energies and the total second quantized energy by the same letter. the density of states times E minus mu. This thing is really the chemical potential that we have to add in. I see it's chemical potential times the total number of fermions. This can be written as an integral up to mu, rho, dE. And so there are factors of 2 pi that I won't bother with. Rho of E is given by the derivative of the phase shift that we computed yesterday, times E minus mu. Now I perform, this depends on energy. Yesterday we got a formula for this phi of E in terms of ratio of 2 gamma functions. Now we can integrate that by parts using the fact that the surface term is 0 because of this E minus mu. And we get an integral dE up to mu phi of E. And an important minus sign. So since I gave you phi of E yesterday, I've now given you the total energy. And since I've given you the total energy without all this new stuff, we also see the total energy when mu is non-zero. What's the interpretation of this formula? This formula has 2 complementary interpretations. Interpretation number 1, we start in the vacuum in the past. We evolve in time. We end up in the vacuum in the future. And the amplitude to do that gives us the energy because we compute E to the minus I E times the total time is 0. E to the minus I H T, 0. This is the traditional way of finding energy. You let the system evolve for a long time. You sandwich it back with a vacuum. Take the log, find the phase, you divide the phase by T, and you find the energy. That's the point of view of the left side of this expression, which is the more traditional one. I'd like to give another interpretation of this formula using our in and out formulas. We can think of this as being an S matrix. And as an S matrix element, it's really Z, 0 out, 0 in, and I really stress without e to the minus iht. How do we compute this? Well, we just need to multiply all the, we write the zero back, the zero in is obtained using the zero fermion, so we fill all the in fermion up to some level. And in the future, we fill all the out fermion up to, for simplicity, the same level. But this state differs from that state by a phase. This is by e to the I phi. So we really have a product over all the states, which becomes in the exponent an integral over all the states. There's a factor of I from the phase. There is phi of e. This is the phase of the state with energy e going from the past to the future, times the length of the system, which comes from the density of states. Recalling that these are relativistic fermions, this L equals T. And this computation reproduces the same phase as this one using integration by parts, although the interpretation is somewhat different. So it's a little bit satisfying that this whole way of thinking in terms of in and out, and new in and new out, and always remembering to compute things like that, is really in the spirit of string theory. That what we compute is an S matrix element of transition amplitude from a state in the past to a state in the future. And we use either the same basis of states in the lambda representation, both in the past and in the future, and they are complicated, and the physics is complicated because the states are complicated. Or equivalently, we use the simple states with non-trivial transition between them, and recast everything in the form that we're really familiar with in string theory, that we take these inner products without any time evolution. Any questions before I change the topic? Okay. The next topic is, why does it all work? So I pulled the matrix model out of a hat. I didn't motivate it. I explained how it worked, and we saw some of its features. And we realized that they look the same as the space-time picture we started with. Traditionally, there's a way to explain why the matrix model works using Feynman diagrams and fishnet diagrams and this and that. This is very nice and really works beautifully for the bosonic string, but as far as I know, does not have a generalization to the type zero theory, which is our interest in these talks. So I'd like to give another interpretation of why this thing works, which does not rely on the worldsheet. So the title is, why does the matrix model work? If we look at the semi-classical system, so going back to the first talk, semi-classical picture, and we analyze it in more detail in the worksheet with the cosmological constant and all that, which I have not done here. The system has unstable d-brains, very similar to the unstable d-brains that Sen has studied. So Sen has told us a lot about these unstable d-brains, and this system has d-brains, which really you just open his papers and you just copy what they have to do. And in the bosonic string, these d-brains have the following potential. They have open strings living on them. So here is a d-brain, and it has open strings like that. And in particular, there's an open string tachyon, not to be confused with our closed string tachyon that we have been discussing all along. And the d-brain is unstable, so the potential has a maximum which looks like that. But more detailed investigations show that the potential looks like that. It's unbounded from below on one side and bounded from below on the other side. In the zero B theory, there are also such unstable d-brains, but their potential for the open string tachyon potential looks like that. It's bounded from both sides. This has an obvious interpretation in terms of the matrix model. Here is an unstable particle. We take one of the fermions, put it at the tip of the potential, and it can roll to the left or it can roll to the right. And its potential is bounded on the left because it can't go too low in energy because there are other fermions sitting here. That explains this part of the curve. And it's unbounded from the right because there are no fermions on the right. In the zero B theory, on the other hand, we also have such an unstable fermion, but its effective potential is bounded on both sides. This gives us a new perspective to the question, what is the eigenvalue? What's the target space interpretation of the eigenvalue? Well, from this perspective, the eigenvalue is the open string tachyon on these unstable d-brains. See, what we call space-time keeps changing in these lectures. Every lecture, there's something else which is naturally called space-time. And today, or in this part of today's lecture, it's the open string tachyon on the unstable d-brain. Imagine we have n such d-brains, either here or here, it doesn't matter. So we put not just one brain, but we put n of them. Let me call it little n. How are we going to describe the effective theory of these d-brains? Well, you've learned a lot about d-brains in these lectures, So it's completely obvious what needs to be done. The coordinates of these D-brains are not simply numbers. These T open are not simply numbers, but they become matrices. So T open is an N by N matrix. And in addition, we have UN gauge fields. So this looks a lot like the matrix model. Furthermore, the potential for them is approximately minus sign. The minus is very important. T open square, maybe there is a trace. So here is the matrix model potential. So the leading order action of these unstable brains is exactly the matrix model action. So another way of interpreting the matrix model is taking all the eigenvalues, put them at the top of the potential, and let them go, let all the chips fall. So if they go all on one side, we call it the bosonic string. If half go one side, half go the other side, we call it the zero B theory. If a little bit more than half fall in one side and a little bit less than a half fall in the other side, we call it the zero B theory with Ramon-Ramon flux. So these unstable D-brains know both about the bosonic string, the zero B theory, and even the zero B theory in background flux. Another interpretation of that is start from the answer. Namely, let's start from either the bosonic string or the zero B theory in its ground state like that, and take one of the fermions from here and put it here at the top. This is clearly an excitation of the system. This is the unstable brain that we started with. So you see we can go back and forth between the two pictures and we always land on our feet, which is a sign that this picture is correct. I would really like to stress that this unstable D-brain, although well-defined semi-classically, is not well-defined in the full quantum theory. It's always true that unstable particles are very hard to define precisely in an interacting theory. It's very easy to define them semi-classically. They appear as resonances, some poles in the complex plane. It's very hard to make precise, especially as the couplings become larger and larger, the resonances become broader and broader and stay further and further out of the real axis. In that case, it becomes much more confusing. Let's see a demonstration of this here. So we put this metastable guy here. Here is the Fermi C. And imagine we have a knob we can turn to change mu. So we make mu bigger and bigger. So this guy becomes more and more unstable because the quantum fluctuations become bigger and bigger. As mu equals zero, it really sits. It's the same as all the other fermions. We can't say that we have such a fermion at all. It's really part of the C. And as we make mu even higher, we can't tell whether we had a D-brain there before or not. The whole thing was washed out. As we keep increasing mu, there is a new unstable D-brain that we can put here, which is really a hole, cutting a hole in the Fermi C here. That's another D-brain, not the same one. It's related to the original D-brain by our S-duality transformation. And it becomes a precise notion. We have seen a version of this in the zero A theory, which is my next topic, where we saw how D-brains, in that case it was charged D-brains, could continuously disappear. Oh boy. I'm really behind. So are there any questions before I switch to the next topic? I don't understand the question. Yeah, I think it is clear, because if you start with finite n with just this potential, you're not going to get anything. The whole thing will just fall. So you really want to regularize and find more terms in the potential when you work with finite n. And it's really important for the whole thing to work to take n to infinity and push the walls and the potential to infinity at the same, at an appropriate rate, so that you find a good limit, which is what the double scaling limit is. There might be an analogy, but I don't see precise. Well, it's clearly analogous from the technical point of view that you take scaling limit. But it's also analogous to a dozen other problems in physics where you take a scaling limit. But you probably have in mind more detailed analogy. It's unlike ADS-CFT, where you take the scaling limit, where you start from a theory in flat space, you put a brain in, and you put more brains in, and then you take a scaling limit of these. Because here, the D-brains is what makes the background. You don't have a linear dilaton background. You put the D-brain in to find the linear dilaton background. The linear dilaton background is what you would have found after the D-brains have decayed. So in that sense, it's not exactly the same. So in the next 12 minutes, I'll start describing what I planned for about half an hour, just repeating the whole thing for the zero A theory and get new insights from there. Except that now it's a little bit easier for us than for the zero B, because we take this interpretation and we know what to do with zero A. Well, we start from the unstable D brains. Fortunately, Sen told us what the D brains are. So the title is 0A. The unstable brains are really D debob brain. We take a charged D brain, we take its antiparticle, anti-D brain, putting them together, that's the unstable D brain of the system. So we're going to take N of these pairs. And their effective Lagrangian is as follows. First of all, T open is complex and by N matrix. And the symmetry is not UN, but UN cross UN, acting on T open by conjugation. And the Lagrangian, so I'll denote that by phi, phi being a complex n by n matrix. And the Lagrangian is trace, covariant derivative of phi, absolute value square, minus v of phi dagger phi. And now it's really straightforward to analyze this system. We diagonalize phi. We do the same thing as before. We diagonalize phi. We look at the measure. We find that these lambdas are fermions. We do not fix the gauge symmetry that rotates lambda by a phase. So we still have lambda I goes to e to the I alpha I lambda I. So these are U1 to the power n U1 symmetries that we haven't fixed yet. We could have fixed them, but let's not do that yet. So now we have n fermions. Each of them has coordinate lambda. Lambda is a complex parameter. So unlike having before, we had real eigenvalues moving on a line. Now every eigenvalue is a complex number, moving, which means that it's a particle moving in the plane. So we have n fermions. Moving in C. But we still have to remember the extra U1 symmetry. What does the extra U1 symmetry do? What does it do? It rotates the plane. So Gauss' law tells us that the states have to be invariant under that U1 symmetry. So Gauss' law tells us that the angular momentum of each fermion is zero. Each fermion moves on a plane, but it is in an S wave. So we could have chosen now a gauge with lambda positive and real. Maybe I should say real and positive, which will be like the radial direction in that plane. And what's the Hamiltonian? The Hamiltonian is no longer minus d lambda square. But because we are in two dimensions, it's changed. And there's a minus 1 over lambda, d lambda, lambda, d lambda, plus v of lambda square. And what do we do for fermions in the plane? It's completely standard. We define new wave functions, which are the same as the old wave functions, multiplied by 1 over root lambda, psi tilde. And that maps up to another Hamiltonian, h, maybe h tilde, which is minus d lambda square plus v of lambda square. But now, a minus, well, that's important, minus 1/4 over lambda square plus v of lambda square, where this is the part coming from the angular momentum, which is the centrifugal force comes from the change of variables. This is completely standard, and you learn that in your quantum mechanics class. How can we solve this system? Well, we can solve the system by diagonalizing this Hamiltonian using special functions. But by now, we know better that the way to solve the system is to go to the S and U variables. Finding S and U variables for this system, for this Hamiltonian, is difficult. However, if we step back and remember the problem not here, the problem earlier in the plane, the problem is completely standard and simple. Because unlike the previous problem where we had one harmonic oscillator, we will not go to polar coordinates, but instead we will work in Cartesian coordinates. We are in two dimensions. So what we have is two inverted harmonic oscillators, an harmonic oscillator in the x direction and harmonic oscillator in the y direction. So now we have two S variables, two U variables, and we have to impose that the total angular momentum is zero. So let me do it briefly. So if we work, so we have a problem with two inverted harmonic oscillators. Each of them has S and U. So if we don't have the constraint on the angular momentum, it's just two copies of the previous problem. Instead of S and U, we have SI and UI, I being 1 or 2. These are the two coordinates in the plane. So this is X plus PX, this is X minus PX, and this is the second one here is Y plus PY, and the other is Y minus PY. But we want to work in polar coordinates. So we define S to be the square root of S1 square plus S2 square. And U, the square root of U1 square plus U2 square. But unlike the previous problem, S and U, S is the radial direction in the two S's, and U is the radial direction in the two U's. So even though S1 is conjugate to U1, S2 is conjugate to U2, S and U are not conjugate pair. which are not the same as U and S, respectively. The Hamiltonian, it's very much like before, is 1/2 S anticommutator with PS, or equivalently is a minus sign U with its conjugate momentum. But it's a little bit more complicated because PS is no longer U. So in this case, changing from the S basis to the U basis is not going to be, it will be a non-local transform, as before, but it's not a Fourier transform. Before we had a Fourier transform taking us from the past to the future. Now we have another transform, which is not a Fourier transform. But this simple form of the Hamiltonian really makes it easy for us to diagonalize it. So very much like before, we have out states, which are 1 over root 2 pi, s to the ie minus 1/2. And we have in states, a minus sign here because there's a minus sign here. But again, there's another distinction between this setup and what we had before. Before, both S and U could be both positive and negative. Now they are a radial coordinate. They're both positive. And therefore, there's only one such state. So instead of having two states that we had before, we have only one state. So I'll do that in a little bit more detail tomorrow, where I'll also introduce Q. If I had the fifth lecture, maybe I could have finished. So I'll stop here. Are there any questions? I just included the lambda square, so I failed to say that. So we'll take this, we'll take a scaling limit, and in the scaling limit, this becomes minus lambda square. Is that the answer to your question? The second term is important. This term? Yeah, this is the centrifugal. It is included there. That's the beauty of this. The whole thing with the lambda square and the 1 over lambda square are still a free relativistic, will end up being a free relativistic Hamiltonian, including the centrifugal barrier.